Canon Press Audio presents the Grace Agenda 2018, Enraging the Culture, a conference featuring Douglas Wilson, Peter Jones, Joe Boot, Ben Merkel, and Toby Sumter. Copyright 2018. Thanks for listening.
I just made the comment that I finished right on time.
Look at you.
I'm so proud.
That's right.
And I didn't know it.
Way to endear yourself to us all. I think an easy question to start off with, Dr. Jones, as far as for you, as you are developing this way of articulating the notion of oneism and twoism, what were some of the either books or resources that helped you shape that articulation of that that mindset?
There have been some really good thinkers of the Christian faith recently. I'm thinking of Francis Schaeffer, who taught Christians how to think. And then, of course, Van Til, a professor and colleague of my father-in-law, who was at Westminster in Philadelphia, who developed the absolute epistemological significance of the creator-creature distinction. And some people think that I took all that from him. Well, actually, I took it from the Apostle Paul. And I'm glad, because I never did have him as professor. But he is a very fine thinker, and I would recommend your reading of his book, In Defense of the Faith as One, where he develops this notion of the creator-creature distinction as the essential way of understanding the human lot and the revelation of the gospel.
Thank you. Someone asked, are modernism and postmodernism types of oneism, or are they types of unbelief that try to work within a twoism world or something else?
They're all onist. Modernism denies that there is such a thing as a creator, and so builds a world around what I said, the self-creation of matter. That's all you can say. Postmodernism goes even further by denying that there's any way of actually speaking about it. So postmodernism is really the ultimate form of oneism because it denies logic altogether and simply makes the individual deciding on his or her needs or desires the one who puts the world together.
A question I think will sort of bridge your two talks. Someone asks, doesn't intersectionality, which is artificially dividing humans into separate distinct groups based on various disadvantages or privileges that they cannot share experience. It's a hot button kind of position that people hold out there. And therefore they can't share the truths. Does intersectionality undermine the all is one indistinguishable tenet of oneism?
Before I forget, I'll answer it.
You better.
It's the ultimate form of oneism, actually. You know, some of you heard mention of Jordan Peterson, and I was listening to him the other day speaking about intersectionality, and he began to add together all the various things that people claim that makes them different, like a black female lesbian. That's intersectionality of those three elements. And he went on to add things, and he said, the further you go, you get to actually to defining every individual. Every individual has special things about them. And so in the end, you have eliminated any notion but pure individualism if you go along that line. And that, of course, is ultimate oneism as well.
Just to piggyback on that really briefly, you just end up with that absolute individualism is back to where you were talking about. There's no communication.
Yep.
There's no, you can't communicate. You're so absolutely removed from everyone that you have to invent a separate, language for you that no one in the universe speaks. So it completely destroys any kind of communication.
That's right.
Toby, how do you answer Christian men who protest that the feminists have ruined modern men?
Well, I agree with them. I think we have been ruined, and that's why we need Jesus. So the issue isn't that. So every single man has breathed the air that they were born into in this generation. Every one of us has imbibed various pieces of Kate Millett's project and everybody of her ilk. So all of us are contaminated by it, and that's why I made the comment. I wasn't trying to say that Jordan Peterson has nothing helpful to say. I think he does, but he is ultimately, fundamentally, at this point, still a humanist.
Sure, he is.
And so we can't. That's why I think there's some danger there, because you can't just say, "All right, I'm going to try harder. I'm going to fix this." No, you won't. No, you won't. And the feminists will keep running circles all around you. But if you recognize that you're part of the problem, we're part of the problem, and you lay yourself, you submit yourself, you come down on your knees and you say, "I am part of the problem." The gospel promise is that Jesus raises you up. He raises you up, he makes you clean, he makes you new, and he begins to make you useful for the kingdom. So yeah, you are messed up. We're messed up. And that's why Jesus came. And he came for every generation, for every one of, every generation has their Kate Millets. Every generation has those that have come against the church, come against the family, come against men, and sought to bring many mighty men down. And they have. And that's why Jesus came.
Is there a danger, though, in sort of saying it's all their fault and not owning it as ours? If that makes sense?
Oh yeah, sure. No, absolutely. So yeah, I'm not saying it's their fault. It's our fault.
Right.
It's our fault. The devil uses all kinds of things against us, But the instinct, the moment God walks into the garden after Adam and Eve have sinned is the woman you gave me. And this is the serpent. We all want to blame somebody, and God says, "No, it's your fault." And so this is where it. So absolutely, yeah, it's not their fault. There's a different dragon in every culture. There's a different serpent. There's a different fruit. But it's still you. You are responsible for God. You're going to stand before God one day, and you're going to give an account. And that account is either going to be recognizing that that you failed, you sinned, you made those choices. And that your only hope, your only righteousness, your only goodness was in Jesus.
For a wife that's maybe looking at a husband who is not, or who is giving his strength to women, and what should a wife do in that setting where she's maybe been one of the ones tempted to aid and abet his abdication? And she maybe the light comes on for her first. What should she do in that?
As usually happens.
Right. What advice, counsel, would you give to a woman in that?
First Peter 3 is the place. First Peter 3 is where Peter is giving instructions to a wife with a lunkhead husband, and it's a husband who's being disobedient to the word. Right? Wives, submit yourselves to your husbands, so that even if they're not being obedient to the word, they'll be won over. So this is I would submit that 1 Peter 3, 1 through 5 there is a resistance manifesto to every Christian woman. It's a resistance manifesto. The point of it is not to say, you just need to make better muffins and, good luck. The point of it is to say, you're a woman. You are an agent. You are a member of the human race. You bear the image of God, and you have power too. You have strength too. But the problem is that frequently women think that their power is in wrangling their husbands with their words. I will get him. And they chase him around the house. You know, come on, come on, do family devotions. Come on, don't you want to be a man? And that's a great way to get your man not to want to be that. So Peter says, win him over without a word. Win him over with the power that God's given you. And your power, your glory, is a lovely, Christ-adorned life. Yeah. You know, it's a glory, it's a beauty, and it's precious in the sight of God. And so what does God do with things that are precious to him? He guards them. Right? He's watching, and so he's the one that's going to act for you. And so 1 Peter 3, I would say, go there and say, okay, your husband's not being obedient to the word, right? He's not submitting to the battles that God's put before him. He's being defeated. He's giving in. Well, what do you do? Well, you trust yourself to God, and so that you're fearless, like Sarah. And you say, all right, God, I'm going to love this man. I'm going to respect this man. I'm going to adorn my life with the beauty of Christ in every area. And God, you act. And you change. That's that kind of respect, that kind of beauty is powerful. It's powerful, and it makes men want to be men.
I want to say that my wife rarely nags me. Listen to that, honey. But her silence is devastating. It is so guilt-inducing, I can hardly stand it. So she gets changes in me that I never thought I could ever make. And I think that's the power sometimes of a godly woman.
Can you develop further the what sort of positive of what a woman should be spending her strength on? What is?
I briefly waved my hand at it as I was going through the talk, but I think the rest of Proverbs 31 is picking that up. It's that, you know, she's to gird her arms with strength because she's making a home, she's cultivating beauty, and she's nurturing life. So those are the three areas where I would say that's your glory, your strength. God gave you strength to make home, to cultivate beauty, and to nurture life. And you do that, I said, you know, boys come out, their moms, and they where's my sword? Right?
I need something to hit.
Yeah. And girls come out and they say, where's my baby? Right? Where's my baby? And they, right, that'll do. You know, whatever. You know, anything and every, stuffed animal, this thing, that's my baby. And they start making homes. You think about this, this is embedded in the way that God made them. The XY and XX chromosomes are there from conception. And it says within a few weeks that the uterus is already being knit together inside of a tiny little embryonic girl, right? She's made to make home because she is a home. She is a home.
And it's not accidental that in our modern abortion on demand culture, the thing that any husband that's watched his wife give birth to a child knows, that's what strength is to be spent on, right. And so we've belittled labor, pregnancy, labor, delivery, and saying, oh, that's just something to do, that's just.
This stuff is very countercultural, isn't it? I don't live in Moscow. I live in California, and you rarely hear this kind of discourse, even in the churches. Yeah. And you watch the way young women are trained in the universities today, and they're the new men. They're the people taking over all the power. They graduate much more than men do. They're starting to make more money than men do. Of course, they live longer than men do, which is a biological fact. And I wonder how we can reintroduce into the Christian church even these kinds of principles, because I see them as right now very countercultural, even for the church.
I think the picture that you put up of your family is how we do it.
Right.
I think the whole project, the whole sexual revolution project, the whole rejection is a complete dead end.
It is.
It's a complete dead end. And the men like your son-in-law, you know, I think when Christian men love their wives, and when wives respect their husbands and they raise their children up in the Lord, there is something there that is absolutely unanswerable.
I think a couple weeks ago we were having a beer at Bootser's with Pastor Wilson, and he said something about, why don't on these personality tests that say, you know, what you should become, why doesn't it ever say for a woman taking the test, you should have lots of cute babies? you know, you should have, and have lots of them. And again, it's we hate children. We hate what that says about the way the world is.
Yeah, a few years ago, I'd come home from work, and my wife was finishing making dinner in the kitchen, and I was reading or something, and I hear she gets a phone call, and she's, you know, bustling around the kitchen getting stuff together, and hello, and I, you know, somebody's called, and I can tell it's some kind of survey, and she's kind of briefly walking through a survey, and I get the questions, and I realize, oh, okay, she graduated from the University of Idaho, so there's some kind of alum, you know, survey thing, and at the end they're doing the demographic stuff. You know, and I hear her say, you know, from out of your corner of my, you know, homemaker. I'm a wife and a mom. That's what I do. And she gets off the phone a couple minutes later, and she said, the girl I was talking to had never heard of a homemaker.
When I came to the States in the 60s, I'd never heard of home economics, but that was a course that was being taught in all the universities. I bet you don't find that taught anymore.
Right. So it's nothing is more enraging to a culture who wants their birth rate to be zero than Christian families having 4, 5, 6, 7. In some cases, I think somebody here has like, what, 19 kids? Something like, nothing is more enraging than that. So the substance of this Q&A seems to be, go have more kids and go enrage the culture.
Amen. Right?
Yeah. Let me change gears for one final question here. How important is it, as we're looking at engaging and enraging, this is our spin, is enraging the culture, how important is it for Christians to, with differences in perspective, various denominations, to work together, form alliances, in the challenge of speaking truth to the rapidly degrading culture of today? How do we do that? You know, forming alliances, maybe across denominational lines and various other theological lines. How should we do that? How should we think about doing that sort of thing?
That's a tough question. I would like to see some denominations do it first. You know, the denominations are split in two over various issues, and I'm not sure you can ever reach over to another group if your own group is split. But I think you're right. Sooner or later, the true Christians will emerge who see the issues and are willing to stand up and be counted. And maybe that's how we will do it. We will see fellow Christians doing what we feel we should do, and we will come and stand with them and help them. But I'm not sure, as far as I can see, that there's any sort of administrative or bureaucratic ways of doing it at this point.
I would say I agree with that, and I think there's, when you're in the, when you're at war, when there's a big battle going on, it's not really that organized. I mean, there's going to be different captains and lieutenants running things, but I think you can try to over-engineer and say, well, let's get all of our troops together in straight lines and so on, and that's a great way to lose. So I think one of the most significant things, one of the most important distinctions is going to continue to be, basically the difference between those Christians who recognize we have to fight, and we have to fight now, and those who are going to continue to say, I think we can figure out some kind of compromise. I think we can figure out some kind of compromise. No, you can't. Yeah. Are we going to fight or not? Yeah. And what I mean by fight is get married, have babies, start Christian schools, start Christian businesses. That's what I mean by fight, by being a faithful witness and saying, no, there's not 3 sexes or 50 sexes. There's just 2, male, female. That's what marriage is. Up is down. Up is up. Down is down. And I'm not going to play any of your games. And I love you, and you can come over for dinner if you want. you know, but that's what, you know, but it's got to be that kind of Christianity with a backbone, Christianity that doesn't care, and is full throated. And I think when that happens, that will make you the right kind of friends and the right kind of enemies.